We're now joined on the line by Matthew Lazar, who is the author of two books on Pacifica. Welcome to Behind the News, Matthew.
Nice to talk to you, Doug.
So I am a negligent radio host, and I do not have the titles of your book, so could you supply those for us?
The first one's called Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network, and the latest is called Uneasy Listening, Pacifica Radio's Civil War. The last is kind of a history of the entire organization from start to finish. The first deals mostly with the early years of Pacifica Radio.
Okay, so how is Pacifica governed in those early years?
Well, in the early years, it was a staff-run. In the early years, there was only one radio station, Doug, and that was KPFA in Berkeley, which was founded in 1949. The Pacifica Foundation itself was registered with the state of California in 1946. KPFA was a staff-run collective started in 1949, and it more or less stayed that way through the early 1950s. It got a stronger board system in the later 1950s because Lewis Hill, the founder of Pacifica Radio and KPFA, became a little bit disenchanted with the staff-run collective business. But mostly, still the staff played a very, very important role in governance through the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Now, Hill's original vision was of a very broadcaster-producer-centered regime, wasn't it?
It was a very broadcaster-producer-centered regime. There was no... The subscribers did not have any political power in the early years, and that was deliberate on Lewis Hill's part. He was... After all, it should be remembered, he was someone who had taken a very unpopular position during the Second World War. That is to say that he and his friends were radical pacifists who had been conscientious objectors during the Second World War. Many of them had been in prison during the Second World War. It's a largely forgotten fact that about a fifth of all people in prison during the Second World War were, in fact, federal prison, were, in fact, conscientious objectors. He understood that the that he'd taken an extremely unpopular position, and was suspicious of popular democracy. He didn't really think that popular democracy would protect radical ideas and freedom of speech. He saw how quickly the United States had gone from being very suspicious of getting involved in the war in Europe to basically becoming completely engulfed in it. And when the Second World War was over, he wanted radio stations that would promulgate pacifist ideas, but he understood that while everybody loves pacifists, they only love pacifists until there's a war. And then suddenly people become very suspicious of pacifists. So he was not a big fan of the idea of the subscribers voting in elections.
Okay, so then let's move on. Other stations joined the network. How was the place governed in the 60s and 70s?
Starting in the... KPFA was 1949, and then KPFK in Los Angeles in 1959, and WBAI, which was already a radio station, joined the network in 1960. And then in 1970, Pacifica developed KPFT in Houston and WPFW in 1977, WPFW in Washington, D.C. After the late 1960s, the Public Broadcasting Act was passed, and there was a Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and CPB grants came with a requirement, which Pacifica began taking, came with the requirement that each station had a local advisory board. They had all had some kind of a board, but now they had formal local advisory boards through the 1970s and 1980s and 1990s. These were strictly advisory boards, which were part of the requirement for taking CPB money. Starting in the 1980s, after the final station joined the network, WPFW in Washington, D.C., Pacifica began getting more ambitious. It began, with the election of Ronald Reagan and with the left's preoccupation with media and the role of media in national politics, a lot of eyes began turning to the Pacifica Radio Network as a stronger alternative to corporate media and even to national public radio, which was overwhelming the Pacifica Radio Network by this point and really taking away a lot of listeners. A lot of ideas began floating around about centralizing the organization. making it more than the sum of its parts. It was a pretty decentralized organization in the early 1980s and such. And so you saw successive generations of people who came in and began experimenting with various ways of centralizing resources and stuff like that. And most of these were pretty well-meaning. And this accelerated in the 1990s with more national programming, a lot of experiments, which ultimately resulted in Democracy Now, starting in 1996. But a lot of this came with a kind of a price tag to it. And that is that because Pacifica Radio is largely still, even with Corporation Public Broadcasting money, a largely listener subscriber, volunteer based organization, there's only so much centralizing you can do without creating a lot of internal conflict and a lot of internal slack. And you began getting this kind of civil war between the largely volunteer-based stations and the national board, especially starting in the late 1990s with the Pat Scott administration.
The national board at this point was still, as they say, a self-perpetuating organization, right? They chose their successors.
Well, actually, that's not exactly true. The national board in the 1990s consisted of a board which consisted of delegates who came from the local advisory boards. There was a lot of dispute back and forth about this, but most of the people who came from the national board were, in fact, delegates from the local advisory boards. As Pacifica began more and more centralized in 1999, in February of 1999, in fact, the national board very controversially eliminated that, became a self-perpetuating board. And at this point, it took on a former Corporation Public Broadcasting operative named Lynn Chadwick as the executive director. She began firing people. She fired the general manager at KPFA, Nicole Sawaya, leading the staff there to think if there was a bloodbath coming. And there was a whole lot of conflict at the station. And in my opinion, Chadwick became more and more paranoid and frankly weird. And eventually she just shut the station down, basically causing this three-week riot, nonstop riot in the city of Berkeley. You really had to be here to see it. I saw it myself. There was, for 3 days, there was practically no police protection in the city of Berkeley and neighboring cities because there were so many police surrounding KPFA. There were people sitting in on the local freeway, on the nearby freeway. It was just quite amazing. And to make a long story short, ultimately what happened was is that the staffs of KPFA and the staff of WBAI, which also found itself facing the gun from the national board, allied themselves with listener activist groups that had always been very discontented with the direction that Pacifica had going, overthrew the old national board, forced them to sue for peace, and in 2002 and 2003, the listeners, for the first time in Pacifica history, got the right to vote in elections, and we got the system that we have now.
Was there a model for this? Who came up with this idea?
I'm sorry, was this who came up with the idea?
Yeah, was there a model it was based on, and who invented this this approach to governance of the network?
You know, that's a good question. Exactly where did the model come from? There are other radio stations and TV stations. There are some that also have been democratic. I believe you mentioned you wanted to ask me about KQED.
Yeah, I do want to get to that in a moment, yeah.
San Francisco. KQED in San Francisco was itself had a subscriber elected board until 1996. There are other examples. San Diego has a community college radio station, which has an elected board. The Pacifica board, the experiment that's taking place now, I think is pretty unique in the United States. I know of no other, fairly sizable broadcasting network with 95,000 subscribers that, is as democratized as Pacifica Radio is.
Well, as a long-term observer of Pacifica, how do you think it's working?
Well, so far, I don't think it's worked all that well. It's caused a tremendous amount of conflict and acrimony. I'm not sure I understand how it has improved the organization in any particular way. That is to say, I don't know whether getting rid of it is the solution. I'm not sure whether any other system would help Pacifica anymore, because there are a lot of other factors that are hurting Pacifica Radio at this point. The general problem of the state of over-the-air broadcasting and the enormous amount of revenue and attention that Web 2.0 has taken away from conventional broadcasting is a really big problem for Pacifica Radio and for everyone else. But thus far, I think the electoral process can be described as a pretty acrimonious and resource-draining experience for Pacifica Radio. I think that...
Resource-draining in both human and monetary terms, right?
Yes, people and money. Yeah, absolutely. I think that for me, the biggest concern that I have about the electoral process is that a lot of the expectation of people who run for the board is that they will have an influence, a direct influence on programming. That is to say that they will just be able to sit on the board and tell the stations you should program this way or you should program that way. And while I think it's appropriate for the boards to be able to have influence in terms of hiring, firing, general managers, strategic plans, labor relations, and budgets and such, the expectation that you sort of have this direct influence on programming, I think is very unhealthy for independent journalism. I don't think that it is a good idea for programmers to feel, or for station managers to feel, that at any time they're going to be second-guessed by these boards. And also, there's always the risk of disgruntled ex-programmers running for the board, largely not because they really want to help the station, but because they want to get their jobs back, or they want to get their programming back, or because and various kinds of factional maneuvers can take place. So I think that that is probably the biggest concern that I have, the expectation that people think that they should basically run for the board so that they can directly influence programming.
All right, we've only got a minute or so left, but we did touch on the KQED question. They did have a similar governance structure and undid it a few years ago. Why and how?
Well, the why is an interesting question. The presenting reason that you read KQED flack say in the newspapers was that it costs too much. They estimated that it cost $250,000 a year, I believe, or often cost $250,000 an election, which they argued could buy quite a lot of programming. The example that they often gave was that the morning show that KQED had, run by Michael Krasny, cost about $250,000 for 6 months, and so that was a cost. There are some worries. One has some worries about about the reform that KQED enacted, which was basically it got the voters to eliminate their right to vote on the board. They had an election in which the voters basically gave up their right to have elections. And there were some scandals that took place at KQED some years ago. Most famously, a program about the Mondavi Winery up in Northern California that was paid for by Mondavi. And that was a big concern. And I wonder where the checks and balances are to prevent things like that happening if you don't have some kind of formal listener viewer process. But for better or worse, KQED did get rid of its board system around 2006. Excuse me.
All right, we have to bring it to an end there. Thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Matthew Lazar, who is the historian of the Pacifica Network, author of the Pacifica Radio, Rise of Listener-Sponsored Radio, and Uneasy Listening, about the civil wars in the Pacifica earlier in this decade. Thanks for joining us, Matthew.
No problem, Doug. Thank you.
We will take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about autos.